Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Returning for his third appearance on Research on Religion, my guest today is Professor Ron Hassner, a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Hassner specializes in the study of religion and international conflict and has authored numerous articles in journals such as the Journal of International Affairs, International Security, Politics and Religion, and Security Studies. But not satisfied with just articles, this professor writes books too. Books, I tell you, it is the wave of the future. These books include War on Sacred Grounds, which we have talked about on past shows, the edited volume Religion in the Military Worldwide, which we've also talked on a past podcast, and now the recently published Religion on the Battlefield. Last year when we had Ron on the program, I promised to get him back on the show when that work was hitting store shelves. It's hitting store shelves now, and I'm a man of my word, so here he is back again, locked and loaded to talk about some religion and politics on the battlefield. I should also mention that Ron is an award-winning instructor at Cal, co-directs Berkeley's Religion and Politics program, and founded the Religion and International Relations section of the International Studies Association. Find out all about Professor Hassner and more over at our website because there are links galore. Ron, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Glad to be back.
Okay. Last year we had you talking about religion in the military and the edited volume that you published on that topic. But now you're back with a new book called Religion on the Battlefield. That sounds like it's a rehash of some of your old stuff. So what's the difference here with this new book?
So there's some overlap, I guess, between religion in the military and religion on the battlefield, because both are interested in how religion interacts with military operation and military personnel. And I actually wanted to write this last book first. I really wanted to write a book about how religion affects modern military operations, particularly where you'd least expect it to matter, in professional first world country militaries that seemingly would be rational and ends-oriented and efficient, the places where you'd least expect that religion would somehow influence military decision-making. So I really wanted to write that book first. I couldn't. The information was simply not out there. Nobody had asked the question. Nobody had collected information. And in fact, the information on religion in militaries around the world was pretty weak. And so I got together a group of scholars and started asking them questions about the militaries that they had expertise on. I brought together a couple of scholars who were experts on the Turkish military. Again, a military where you wouldn't think that religion would play an important role, but it did. A couple of experts on the American military, an expert on Israel, an expert on India, etc. And I asked them essentially two kinds of questions. First, I asked, tell me about religion in your military. What are the demographics? Do soldiers come from different religious traditions? Are units organized by religion? Does religion affect promotion? What sort of religious practices do soldiers engage in? So that was question type number one. And then question type number two was, does this matter? Does it actually affect what this military does when it goes out to the battlefield? And I never got an answer to question number two. Mm-hmm. Not a single one of the authors could actually give me a good current example or quite recent example because they hadn't studied the question. So I published their answers to question number one, and that's the edited volume, and then I sat down to write this book, which is my answer to question number two. Does religion in the military matter? Does it actually shape military operations?
Yeah, and that is a really cool question. The way that you approach it is very novel. You're right that the way that, or the questions that you're asking are ones that haven't been asked, because usually the typical question of religion in the military or religion on the battlefield is, why does religion motivate conflict, right? That's the typical question. So you're doing something a little bit different there, right? With the, I mean, give us a sense of where the literature was in terms of religion and conflict. And you talked a little bit about religion and military, but where was the literature on religion and conflict before you started writing this book?
Because the literature is driven by 9/11 to a large extent, by the Iranian Revolution a little earlier, by Samuel Huntington's work, the focus in the study of religion and conflict has always been on religious ideas, so conversations in people's heads with themselves or with God about meaning, religious ideas, and how they propel people into battle. And the people we were primarily interested in were terrorists, and we may as well be blunt about it. We were interested in Muslim terrorists. So that was the field. Insurgents, terrorists, non-state actors, primarily Muslim, propelled by radical religious ideas that caused them to participate in violence. Here's what the literature did not look at. It wasn't really interested in what happens once the violence starts. So granted, we're looking at a Muslim terrorist who, say, has this idea about 72 virgins and he now participates in violence. What happens once the violence starts? Does religion still matter? That was a question that was not asked. How does this affect state actors, like militaries, like intelligence agencies? Number three, how does this affect non-Muslim actors? And fourth, and this for me was the biggest issue, why is it always about religious ideas? When we know that for most religious practitioners on the planet, religion is not an idea only. It is a set of ideas and practices. It's social networks. It is texts. It's rituals. It's diets. It's ways of dressing and talking. It's rules about how you raise your children and how you have sex and who you can marry and what days of the week you can drive your car. It's not just about internal dialogues and abstract ideas. So I wanted to push in the precise opposite direction with this book. So I'm not writing about insurgents and terrorists. I'm writing about modern professional militaries, mainly American and British armed forces.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to pick up your book and saying, oh, this is another book on Islam and politics.
Right,
and
which is on the first page. I say, this is not a book about Muslim terrorists.
Exactly, yeah.
I say, straight out, just so you, let the buyer beware. It's been written about. It's an important topic. It's a good topic. I am not of the... Muslim terrorism has nothing to do with Islam, despite the fact that Muslim terrorists tell us it has a lot to do with Islam. I'm not of that school. But I'm also a little bored with that literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm pushing in the opposite direction, first by looking at professional militaries, second by looking at religious practices and not just ideas, third by looking at Christians primarily and not Muslims, and fourth by looking at what happens after the soldier enters the battlefield. So religion here is not just a motivation, but it shapes decisions made at every point on the battlefield.
Yeah, I really love the focus on the rituals and the practices, because those impact things a lot. We don't necessarily think about that, right? If you can't drive on a certain day, well, you know, if you're really going to take religion seriously in the military, you can't be driving, you know, the Humvee on that day, right? That's going to affect strategy. And so we're going to go into that. But I have to say, buyer beware as well, because even though this is not about Muslim terrorists, this is actually a really fascinating read. And you pull examples from all over the place, which makes it a fun book. It's not just, you have a case study of the Iraq War at the end of the book, but it is a tour de force of the last couple centuries of war, so to speak. And you start off the book with this great interesting observation and a puzzle, and I always love puzzles here. It's a puzzle about British military chaplains in World War I, of all places, and you noticed a really odd pattern. And this was something that I don't think most people would even think to notice. You call it a very important mini case study, and it helps to illustrate some of the central themes of your book. So tell us how you stumbled upon this little odd case of chaplains in World War I. What was going on there, and what do you think was happening?
Right. So because there is no literature on military practices, religious practices in militaries, and why they matter or how they matter, my only way of getting information is to read everything I could read. And I focused primarily on World War I, World War II, British and American sources and experiences. Because in the few cases where people do write about religion in the Christian world, authors always tend to flee to the Crusades, which is sort of a dirty move, right? Because if instead of studying radical Islam, you are now studying 12th century Christianity, what you're really saying is, oh yes, we used to do that crazy stuff too, but we don't do it anymore. And I wanted to show that we actually do it, we just do it in different forms and different ways. So I wanted to really limit myself to 20th century examples with some cool cases from the American Civil War, because it's very well documented. So I'm reading everything I can about religion in the British Expeditionary Force and the American Expeditionary Force in the trenches of World War I, and I keep coming across this strange pattern, and here's the pattern. The British send about, well, we don't know, but the British send many, many hundreds of chaplains into the trenches of World War I. And it's really the first time that chaplains are assigned to the battlefield in a more or less institutionalized way. So in prior wars, chaplains just sort of show up. They volunteer. In World War I, the British start sending chaplains in a semi-organized manner to the battlefield, although they haven't quite figured out where these chaplains are supposed to be and what they're supposed to do. And of those many hundreds of chaplains, about 100 die in the trenches of World War I. And of those, 20-something die in action. That is, they don't die of typhoid in the medical tent in the back. They don't die while conducting a funeral. They actually die while charging with their troops across no man's land. So of those 20 that die in action, the majority are Catholic chaplains. And this is strange, because these are British chaplains. And so naturally, most of them are Anglican, mm-hmm. and not Catholics. In fact, the British send about three times as many Anglicans into battle as they do Catholics, and yet in frontline attacks, Catholics die at twice the number of Anglicans, which means proportionately six times as many Catholics are dying as Anglicans. Not in total, but in frontal charges. Now, these are very small numbers. This is bad statistics, but as far as anecdotal evidence goes, it's very, very strange. And so I started looking at, how did these guys die? Why did they die? Does this have to do with ideas, which is our traditional way of approaching this problem? Is it that they were more courageous? Is it that they were more dedicated to their soldiers? Is it that they felt that they had some sort of divine mission to charge with troops? That turns out not to be the case. There's absolutely no evidence for this. And in terms of medals awarded, Anglicans outdid their Protestant counterparts. So what's the difference? The difference has to do with practice. There's something that Catholic chaplains had to do with their hands and with their mouths and with their bodies in the battlefield during attacks that Anglicans did not have to do. And that had to do with last rites.
Mm-hmm.
So it is for religious reasons that Catholics had to accompany troops as they were charging, because they had to be next to the soldier when the soldier dropped, to give him communion, to pardon his sins, to offer last rites, to anoint with oil, which is something Protestants, Anglicans did too, but they didn't have to do it at the moment of death. They could do it after the fact, back in the medical centers, which, by the way, is a much more reasonable place for a chaplain to be, just because the chaplain can then see more people and be of greater utility. These Catholic chaplains who accompanied troops could never really see more than one soldier at a time, had a very high risk of dying, which would really harm morale. And nonetheless, this is what they did, and they did it not because of abstract religious ideas, but because of very concrete religious practices. And that's why the story is interesting to me.
Yeah, I think so. And we talked about some of the other rituals, the driving and fasting and things like this. The last rites is an important one. Let me just push you, though, on the ideals part. Couldn't somebody come back and say, yeah, but, you know, that ritual is based upon a deep theological idea that you have to anoint somebody at the moment of death and provide last unction right there at the spot, whereas the Protestant's saying, nah, you know, you got a couple days or so.
Right. Yeah, and of course, the distinction between ideas and practices is artificial.
Mm-hmm.
It's analytic. But I think it's analytically useful.
Yeah.
I think it's analytically useful to distinguish between a scholar who looks at abstract principles, and often what scholars do is they find these principles in sacred texts. Very often sacred texts that the actor being analyzed actually has no chance of ever encountering. So, you know, I'm talking here about the just war theory literature, right, where these notions of what Augustine and Aquinas have to say about war, as if soldiers are even aware of these. So there are these abstract notions, and they matter, and they're important. Theology is always there, and religious ideas are always there. But sometimes there's that extra step where the idea is translated into action, into practice, and often the practice is much more important than the idea behind it. And often religious practitioners will partake in the practice while having a very vague notion of the theology behind it. And so I find it, you know, analytically useful to distinguish between these two things. And by the way, we do this when we study politics all the time. Mm-hmm. When we are interested in knowing what's going to happen in the upcoming elections, we do want to know what Republicans and Democrats think. But we sure as hell want to know a lot more about what they're actually going to do. And so interviewing you and finding out your positions on gun control and on abortion and on a whole range of things, it might be interesting. But in the end, I want to know whether you're actually going to vote and what ticket you're going to put in the box on the day of the vote. So, you know, it's just very strange that political scientists who really are interested in material outcomes, in what people end up doing with their bodies, have, in the case of religion, become so narrow-mindedly focused on the idea, the notion, the thought. I think it's important to write about religious ideas. I'd like to complement it with writing about bodies in action.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I would call it just the everyday things that we do because, I mean, it matters so much. And you're absolutely right. Scholars, given that we walk in these ethereal worlds of libraries with great ideas, we tend to think that that's the stuff that happens all the time. But, you know, we forget
and as,
that.
You know, and as you know, there's a big pile of religious practices that have very, very weak theological, ideological.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm talking rosaries. Or a whole range of Jewish, Muslim, Sikh practices that are the product of tradition and habit and superstition more than they are the product of some sort of purified theological notion.
Yeah, no, you would never have discovered this interesting story about World War One, if you had just focused on the big ideas, right? It's just you had to be there. You're messing around in these data things about death certificates and stuff. And so, where did this guy die? What was he doing at that moment? And I mean, it's those things that actually that matter quite a bit, and which is really cool about the book. Let's go ahead and dive into your theoretical framework that you use to help guide us through this discussion of how everyday religious practice affects military strategy and even the day-to-day events on the battlefield. You talk about these concepts and religion as a force multiplier and a force divider, and then you also talk about how religion can inhibit, motivate, provoke, and exploit different situations and people in war. So give us a sense of that framework.
Right. So let me start with the second part. The two are actually one and the same idea. So religious practices have these effects. They have a lot of effects. I'm primarily interested in four of those effects. Two of those four are very helpful to you if you are an army on a battlefield. If a religious practice and I should probably explain, give some concrete examples in a second. If a religious practice in some way encourages you in your fight, then that's a force multiplier. If a religious practice allows you to take advantage of your opponent, because your opponent has some religious practice that constrains them, then it is also a force multiplier. And by force multiplier, I simply mean assume two armies of equal size and equal capability, and one has the good fortune of having religion on its side as a motivator or as an ability to exploit the opponent, and now that army has a leg up. So it's really no different than two armies of equal capability, but one has higher ground. Or, you know, one is swimming with the tide, or you know, whatever the environmental factor happens to be, that takes a balanced battlefield and gives one side a slight advantage. Then there are ways in which religion gets in the way of fighting, and if religion happens to have that impact on you in a particular moment, even if the odds are even, you will now be at a disadvantage. So if religion constrains you in a way, or if you've overexploited your opponent's religion and caused a backlash, so now the opponent is provoked and motivated against you, now religion is a force that weakens you on the battlefield, and it is a force divider. So take the simplest example, and you know, actually sort of a motivating example for the book. Here's a unit of U.S. Marines. They are in hot pursuit of a group of insurgents in an Afghan village. Let's assume the odds are even on both sides. And now the Afghan insurgents hide inside a mosque. And even though you, as a U.S. Marine, are not interested in the mosque per se, you neither want to destroy it nor do you want to conquer it, it's just part of the environment, suddenly this religious practice, which is sacred space, gets in the way of military operations. It is a force divider for you, the Marine, because suddenly you have to hold fire, you've got to stop chasing, you have to start consulting with local Afghans, you probably would like to get permission to enter the mosque. If they won't give you permission, you're going to have to communicate with headquarters and maybe get permission to attack, even though it is a mosque. For the Afghan insurgents, it's a force multiplier. They suddenly have a protection they didn't have before. That's the argument.
Okay, so this is making a lot more sense now. We're going to basically explore some of these questions through your framework here of force multiplier and divider. In terms of these other things, inhibit, motivate, provoke, and exploit. And so those things are starting to become clear as well. Do you want to say anything more about those four factors? I think you covered, you know, exploit or inhibit. Right. What about motivate or provoke?
So I should also say, and let's just skip ahead and say, that these four effects are at work every time a religious practice comes into play. And that practice could be sacred time, and I have a chapter dedicated to that. That practice could be sacred space. That practice could be sacred authority. That practice could be sacred ritual. And each one of those has some force multiplying and some force dividing effects. And sometimes the force multiplying effects are stronger, and sometimes the force dividing effects are stronger, and sometimes it's a close call and it's too hard to tell. So if you are a military unit fighting on the battlefield, and let's say you and I are running a controlled experiment, and suddenly a chaplain materializes out of thin air and begins encouraging your soldiers, you have a slight force multiplier at play. And that's the effect that I call motivation. Imagine now that instead of a chaplain materializing, a sacred time materializes. We've run a controlled experiment and we've suddenly dropped, say, Yom Kippur on the Jewish soldiers on the battlefield. Now you have a constraining effect. Some will be hesitant to fight. Some will be hungry because they fasted. Some will be tired. That's a constraining effect. Others will be furious at the fact that the opponent has strategically chosen to attack them on their holiest day. So now you've got a provocation effect. Those guys might actually be fighting harder and with greater wrath. And if you can get a couple of rabbis to declare that this state of war annuls Yom Kippur, and one should fight as one would on any regular day, which is precisely what happened in Israel in 1973, then again, you have a religious authority figure that acts as a force multiplier. And again, notice, none of this has much to do with ideas. It has to do with the way space is organized and time is organized, and it has to do a lot with rituals and practices, underpinned, of course, by beliefs, but the punchline has to do with the behavior of bodies on the battlefield.
Yeah, let's dive into this more, and let's start off with this thing that you just left hanging there a little bit, sacred time. And I remember when I first interviewed you almost, I think it's 4, maybe even 5 years ago, on your book on sacred space, you were talking about the next project being sacred time. And I think it kind of morphed into this broader project that you just published here. What are we talking about when we mean sacred time? And how is that going to affect all these different effects of inhibition, exploitation, motivation, provocation? Give us some examples to ground
it. So as with sacred space, for religious practitioners, time is not uniform. Some moments are more significant than others. And usually these are moments in which you recreate important historical events in the history of your group. Christmas, you're reenacting the birth of Christ. Easter, you're reenacting the crucifixion and resurrection. There are important theological ideas behind this. But again, I'm less interested in those, and I'm interested in the fact that you are putting up Christmas trees. You are singing Christmas carols. You are exchanging gifts. You're hunting for Easter eggs, right? So that's the practice aspect of sacred time. In most cases, this has a very, very small effect on militaries. In some cases, it has a bigger effect. It can constrain or it can motivate. It can open up a door for exploitation. For some simple reasons, sacred times are times at which people tend to gather. They tend to assemble. That makes them convenient targets. These are times at which things usually prohibited during the year are permitted, or things usually permitted during the year are prohibited. So soldiers may find themselves wearing different clothes, eating different food, abstaining from sleep or sleeping more, abstaining from alcohol or drinking more. Much of this depends on their religious tradition. It depends on how important the sacred day is. It depends a lot on discipline. So an example I like a lot is George Washington crossing the Delaware on Christmas Day and attacking the Hessians in Trenton on Boxing Day, or what the Hessians would have called St. Stephen's Day, which is a heavy drinking day. I'd say it's a binge drinking day in German culture. Now, I have no smoking gun to show that George Washington did this on purpose. There were all sorts of other constraining factors involved. But it would be quite reasonable, if he had even minimal knowledge of Hessian religious practices, for him to assume that the Hessians were going to be drunk out of their minds and would make easy targets. If he assumed that, he would have been wrong to assume that. They were not drunk. They were alert. They were serious professional mercenaries. But it's an example of the kind of ways, often unexpected, in which sacred time can manipulate a religious environment. And again, a good way to think about this is in the same way in which topography or weather patterns manipulate a battlefield, change conditions. And there's not a lot you can do to manipulate it in turn, but you can adapt to it and you can exploit it if you're wise. I'll give one more example, and then we'll move on. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam. Tet is the Vietnamese New Year, which had a whole host of implications for why the northern Vietnamese would want to choose that date to attack the South and the Americans. In part because for Tet, there had been a truce. So you're breaking a truce, and that gives you a surprise element. In part because so many Southern Vietnamese soldiers were at home celebrating with their families, were not listening to the radio, were not picking up phones, refused to return to their units when they were called up. But also smaller things like the practice of bringing carts laden with fruits and vegetables from the countryside into the cities for Tet allowed the Northern Vietnamese to smuggle weapons into the cities. So again, these are pragmatic, pretty straightforward, physical manifestations of religion that give one side a slight edge over the other. It's a force multiplier from a northern Vietnamese point of view.
Yeah, I love the way how you describe that. The time, as also we'll talk about place and other things here, affect the battlefield like topography and weather do, right? So we always see those war films or the real films where you have the general pushing the soldiers on a big, huge board. But, you know, you're talking in fourth and fifth dimensions here of time and other place and
right.
idea.
And we've learned to think about this already. Yeah. We are already very interested in what is Ramadan going to do to levels of violence in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have an intuition about that. I think we have the wrong intuition. We keep thinking about what does Ramadan mean to insurgents, as opposed to asking, what does Ramadan make possible?
Right.
Are the streets crowded? Is there a lot of food? Is there little food? Are mosques crowded? What sort of mosques? How easy is it to get around? How easy is it to move weapons around? I think those things, those physical aspects of religion matter no less than, you know, how does an insurgent contemplate the abstract meaning of this holiday?
Yeah. No, that's just a brilliant insight. It's one of these insights, too, when you mention it, you go, well, of course, why didn't I think about that before? But nobody has thought about it before, or a few people, at least scholars, haven't.
The Egyptians did.
The Egyptians did.
In 1973 did not attack Israel on Yom Kippur because of some notion of redemption and forgiveness having to do with the Jewish Day of Atonement. The Egyptians attacked the Jews on Yom Kippur because they thought they were going to be hungry, because they thought that the radio was going to be off, because they thought mistakenly that the roads in Israel were going to be crowded and filled. I'm hypothesizing that there was a false metaphor drawn here between Ramadan and Yom Kippur. And they turned out to be completely wrong, and it ended, to some extent, giving Israel a leg up, because the roads were, in fact, empty, and troops moved very, very quick, much faster than predicted. But the Egyptian calculations here were not about theology. They were about practice.
Yeah. The scholars pay attention. The practitioners on the ground were way ahead of us on this kind of thing. We always think we're the smartest people in the room, and we're not often. But we still have our jobs. And our next job is to move on to Sacred Space, which was your first book was on sacred space. When I picked up the book and I read the chapter, or I saw the chapter on it, I said, oh, Ron's rehashing his old book. That's the old cheap way of, trying to expand some words there in the book. But no, actually you take this in different directions, which I think is really neat. So tell us about sacred space and also give us a few examples, including the destruction of the Monte Cassino, which is actually my favorite example in the book, and I'm not sure why it hasn't been made a movie yet.
There's a bit about it in The Monuments Men, but that's not a good movie to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay, my first book was about sacred space. So again, for the religious practitioner, space is not uniform. Some places have more mana. Some places allow greater access to the divine. They allow greater healing. They allow better communication. The miracles happen there. That's the underlying belief. And then the underlying practice is things like pilgrimage or prohibitions on access or these beautiful structures that you build that often are very, very sturdy and make for very, very good bases of military operation. So my first book was about conflicts caused by the idea of sacred space, because I was one of those scholars who thought of religion in terms of ideas. Here I'm asking a different question. The question here is, imagine, and it doesn't take a lot to imagine the British and the Americans working their way up the Italian peninsula. They're fighting the Germans with some haphazard help from the Italians. So Christians on both sides. They're not fighting because of religion. They're certainly not fighting because of sacred space. They're not looking to conquer any sacred space or liberate any sacred space. Sacred space is nothing but a nuisance to both sides, but it's there because it's Italy, and Italy is flooded with sacred space. So what do you do? What does this do to your battle planning? And there's a very strong statement from Eisenhower in which he says, and I paraphrase, that sacred space is not going to get in the way of military necessity. We're not going to sacrifice soldiers in order to protect sacred space. But, he says, and this is the part of his statement that's not very often quoted, deciding what is and isn't military necessity isn't always an easy decision to make. So what sacred space often does, and again, we're talking about 20th century secular wars between professional militaries. We're not talking about, you know, the Iran-Iraq war or conflicts in which religion is salient, like the Spanish Civil War or the Yugoslav War. I'm really looking at cases in which religion is not a motivating factor in any reasonable way. What sacred space does is it complicates decision making. Often in the end, a regular decision to charge forward and bomb the place to smithereens is reached. But often that comes after great deliberation and at great cost of life. And Cassino is an example. So in the case of Monte Cassino, we're talking about the oldest monastery in the Christian world. And it happens to sit at the primary German defense line against the Allied advance north through Italy, the Gustav Line. So the Allies have landed through Sicily at the very southern tip of Italy, and they're working their way up towards Rome, and they come across this massive topographic obstacle, the Gustav Line, and in the middle of that line sits this very, very old monastery. And the Americans refuse to bomb it. They try multiple charges. Those are all disastrous. They come at great cost of life. This causes tremendous frustration to American troops because they are convinced that the Germans are sitting inside the monastery and using that as a vantage point to shoot down at the Americans. And even though this monastery is a real thorn in the Allied side, more than two months pass before finally the decision is made to annihilate the monastery. So a few things that need to be pointed out here. First of all, sacred space does not affect the bottom line. The place is bombed. So those impatient political scientists who want to know the punchline and are only interested in the punchline will say religion didn't matter. And if that's the version of the story you're interested in, that's fine with me. If you're interested in the detail, however, the details are interesting. Number one, tremendous hesitation at great cost of life. 2 months of being shelled by the Germans and failed assault after failed assault without the use of artillery anywhere near the ridge for fear of accidentally hitting the monastery. Second interesting story is that the Americans were wrong. The Germans, on principle, refused to enter the monastery. Drew a big circle around it, prohibited soldiers from entering, and when the head of the German command was invited into the monastery for Christmas dinner, he made it a point not to look out of the windows, lest it be claimed that he was taking advantage of the situation. And the last point to be made is that when the monastery is shelled and is in fact annihilated, this causes tremendous propaganda damage to the Americans. It is in fact considered by most observers an act of extreme foolishness. And the Nazis make tremendous propaganda profits out of it, publish reports from the head of the monastery, show pictures, parade the treasures they've saved from the monastery through the streets of Rome. So, bottom line, this is not a conflict about sacred space. This is not a conflict because of sacred space. Both sides would much rather that the sacred space just not exist. But it's there, and you have to somehow deal with it. And this has these varied effects we talked about. It constrains the Americans. It provokes Catholics around the world when the site is destroyed. It also constrains the Germans, oddly. And those are aspects that I think are often neglected in discussions of World War II. And I think that the case of the bombing of Rome then becomes even more salient in my mind.
Yeah, we'll talk about the bombing of Rome in a second, but I just think this would be such a cool movie because it has this psychological aspect of building up. Well, we're not going to bomb it because it's a sacred space, and you know, even though the Germans are in there, we think they're in there, but they're not in there. So there's misunderstandings on both sides of the whole issue, and I'm surprised that no movie has been there. You should, if there's any Hollywood executives out there, I think you should make this movie, and I think you should consult Ron for the script. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And if that does happen, I want you to invite me to the premiere. That's what
absolutely.
I'm
going to say. And we will insist that the role of us in the movie is played by George Clooney and whoever.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner. Jeremy Renner's made our day. So, all right. Anyways, what about the bombing Rome? That's another good example that you use.
So here's, I mean, this is an insane case. You're trying to target facilities in the city of Rome, mainly train depots that the Germans are using to move supplies, weapons, personnel from Germany south through Italy down towards the Gustav Line. So you're trying to bomb these train depots, some of which are in the heart of Rome. But you've given a promise, and Roosevelt has given a promise to the Pope, that he will not damage Christian shrines in the city, which is ridiculous, right? I mean, this is like bombing Berkeley without harming any hippies. there's no way to do this. So my question was this just empty talk on Roosevelt's part, or was there really an effort by U.S. pilots to take appropriate efforts and not harm churches? And amazingly, there was. I sent a very poor, miserable graduate research assistant into the archives. Her name's Alice, and she came out after a couple of months with trembling hand, handed me these amazing maps that were used, handed to U.S. pilots, and were used by the pilots in the bombing of some of these train stations. And the maps have on them the most significant churches in Rome, circled with big bold text underneath that says, "Must on no account be damaged." I have reproductions of these maps in the book. And the pilots tell that these were harrowing flights through anti-aircraft fire because they were told to fly straight line, not even attempt to dodge the anti-aircraft fire, over Rome, and then drop these bombs as precisely as they could at train stations without harming the churches that were on the other side of the street. In part, for example, they took very, very strange routes over the city, routes that didn't make tactical sense in terms of the targets they were trying to hit, just so that if the bombs overshot the target, they would not land anywhere near the major basilica. It was a very noble effort. It failed. A large basilica was hit, in part because American decision makers weren't aware that it was important. They weren't aware that it was part of sort of extraterritorial Vatican space in the city. And again, the propaganda damage to the Americans was very, very bad. And so in part, that leads to the establishment of the Monuments Men, whose job in large part it is to simply provide the army with long lists of sacred places, where they are, how much they matter, which parts of them matter the most, so that as the army moves through Europe, they can try, where appropriate, where possible, not always, to take the measures to protect them. But here, sacred space really has only one effect. It's constraining. It is constantly constraining. Neither the Allies nor the Axis powers ever, at least as far as I could tell, took advantage of sacred space to promote their own cause or to get a leg up.
Yeah, and again, I have to emphasize how cool this research is, because you talk about the rituals and the day-to-day practices. You dug up maps that have big, huge circles on them and say, "Don't bomb here," and that. And maybe we'll put a few of those up on our website or on our Facebook page so people can see these, because it comes down to somebody circling something on a map, and you get to handle that stuff, right? To touch it and say, "Oh, my theory is actually was alive there in 1943 in a cockpit of a, you know, bomber." Like, whoa, that's kind of neat. But let's go ahead and move on to the next one that you asked, the next question. It actually has to do with one of my favorite bands from the 60s, and that's The Who.
Right.
Who is so, The Who?
The Who. So in terms of The Who of sacred practices, I could have written about a whole range of saints and charismatic leaders, but I chose, again, to talk about the most simple, straightforward, day-to-day religious presence on the battlefield, and that's chaplains. And I was very interested in seeing why modern professional armies employ chaplains, what they think those chaplains do, and how soldiers perceive that function. Does it matter in any way? Of course, chaplains are in large part there in order to conduct the necessary religious rituals, which soldiers have a right to conduct under their First Amendment rights. But in a very large part, in World War I and World War II, more so even in the U.S. Civil War, chaplains are there as cheerleaders. They are there as shrinks. They are there to motivate soldiers. They are, to put it very crudely, the mechanism to take a soldier who has returned scarred, wounded, and traumatized from the battlefield, have a 10-minute conversation with that soldier, turn them around, and send them right back to the battlefield. And in that sense, they're a very simple force multiplier. Now, does this work? Evidence is hard to come by, so I'm looking at all sorts of indicators. One indicator is how soldiers write about their experiences with chaplains. And that's in large part how they describe it. They say, you know, I was crestfallen. I was at the end of my rope. I had seen my comrades fall at my side. But the chaplain said X, Y, and Z to me, and he gave me this sermon, and I felt God was at my side. And there he is. He's back in the battlefield. More interestingly, and I think more persuasively, is commanders talking about their chaplains as a force multiplier. And there's some nice Jewish, juicy, also Jewish, but mainly juicy quotes along those lines. And then an interesting sort of side note is how concerned the Axis powers are in the Second World War to constrain the chaplains, the Allied chaplains in POW camps, who they consider to be sources of organization and rebellion and discontent in the POW camp. So that for me was another indicator that chaplains are really quite a powerful force. I'll say one last thing. I was also very interested in looking at the conditions under which chaplains restrain military force. Because if you're into the theology and religious ideas camp, you would have to argue, as Scott Appleby does very nicely, that religion is ambivalent towards war, and that for every chaplain who encourages a soldier, there should be at least one chaplain who discourages a soldier, or who protests to their commander that a war crime has taken place, or who seeks to constrain the use of force in the military in some way. And I could not find a single example. In fact, I could not find a single example of a chaplain claiming, as much as claiming, correctly or incorrectly, that they try to constrain the use of force in the military. So you might call this dismaying or you might call it sobering, but chaplains have really acted as cheerleaders and encouragers of conflict in 20th century combat, U.S. and British, and I have some information from other militaries as well.
Yeah. You think that's a little bit of a self-selection bias here, that the people who are volunteering to go into the military are the ones that, you know, watch the war movies and stuff? Yeah, okay.
Well, self-selection multiple levels, right? Yeah. If you are a pacifist cleric, you probably will not want to become a chaplain. If you do decide you want to become a chaplain, the military is probably going to reject you. So that's the second selection process. And then the third is a socialization process. Regardless of your opinions on war, once you're in the armed forces and in uniform, and you're in this very difficult position of being an officer without real rank, a soldier without a weapon, you sort of have the ear of the common soldier, but you are considered a member of the command corps. So you're sort of liminal, you're between worlds, particularly in this difficult position. We are sort of a half soldier. I think it has been very important for chaplains to show their true grit. And so, very much like the Catholic chaplains in World War I, in World War II, chaplains of all colors and all backgrounds marched with soldiers into battle and stood at their side while the fighting was happening, even though they were unarmed, and took tremendous risk. And I think that's part of the sort of socialization process that chaplains undergo.
Yeah. We have had a military chaplain on the show in the past, and we will link to that podcast as well, so you can get what Ron has found and also some firsthand discussion of what a chaplain does in the military. This was somebody who served in Iraq. So we will link back to that. One other chapter that you have in here organized around your basic journalistic questions, I should say, or your social science questions, was the how. You had the who, we had the what, we had the why and the when, but what about the how?
Right. So the how has to do with rituals. And here, I'm moving very far away from the kind of things that war scholars are interested in. So when it comes to the day-to-day rituals of soldiers, the way soldiers pray together, the little superstitions that soldiers have, the lucky charms that they carry on themselves, some of which are religious, the little chapels that they build on roadsides. When it comes to these, the effect on the battlefield is marginal to none. But I still find them to be fascinating because nobody studies them. And they are of a very wide range. And so let me tell you a story that's not in the book, because in order to introduce it into the book, I would have to go through human subjects committee's approvals. I heard the story from a student of mine, who is of Mormon background, and served, with, an advanced force in Iraq that had to go on very dangerous patrols. On a daily basis, they had to leave their very safe compound in these very large armored vehicles and cross dangerous terrain at heavy loss. And the story is interesting, I think, because, again, it emphasizes the difference between religious ideas and religious practices. Somehow the members of his unit found out that he was Mormon and insisted that before every sortie, he bless the vehicles. And he responded by saying that, first of all, he was not a pious Mormon at all. In fact, had no interest in religion. And second, that Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not include in its arsenal of prayers to protect armored vehicles. In other words, there is no theological underpinning for this whatsoever, but the members of his unit simply didn't care. They said, "You are our lucky Mormon." And when he said, "Why do you need a lucky Mormon?" the answer was, "Because our lucky Jew has just been transferred to another unit. You are other. You're not like us in religious ways, and those religious ways fascinate us." And so he says every day before they went out of the gates, he stood in front of the three vehicles, and he waved his hands in the air, and he mumbled something that he remembered from church vaguely that made absolutely no sense. And it gave the members of his units tremendous comfort. That's religious practice. Yeah. That's religious practice as distinguished clearly from religious ideas. You know, those things don't matter tremendously, but I really think that if you're interested in the religion of soldiers, these stories are worth telling just in and of themselves, just because it's so human, and so fascinating and so rich.
You know, I think I'll push back a little bit. You say that this has marginal to no effect, but it can have a huge morale effect. And, right. And a lot of battles are won on morale. You got the old lines of soldiers marching against one another, and it's basically whoever won that kind of pitched battle was the ones who didn't chicken out first. Right. And if you...
But very difficult to measure the role of religion in morale.
Yeah.
So, for example, the fact that this group of soldiers stood around him and watched as he was conducting this ritual. So is this about them doing something together as a group? Is it about camaraderie?
Mm-hmm.
Is it about unity? Is it about religion? Does it really count as religion if it has really no sort of theological underpinning? Those questions are hard to answer. There is, and I included in the chapter, some very, very interesting, interesting research that I owe very much to my other research assistant, Courtney, on the effects of religious practices and religious beliefs on resilience to battlefield trauma. So this is research that comes out of mental health and out of medicine, and it shows in my mind quite persuasively, although it is novel, that religion offers that extra layer of protection against PTSD, in part because it offers you access to helpful resources like a religious community, like a chaplain with whom you can share your pain, because it offers perhaps some explanation, some justification. in part because religious practices allow you to heal. There's something very meditative and ritualistic. And so mental health studies show quite consistently that soldiers who partake in religious practices have a somewhat higher level of resilience to battlefield shock. So that's interesting. And then the last question we need to ask, and that's a question that I really leave open primarily in the chapter, is the reverse question. Not how does religion affect the behavior of soldiers on the battlefield, but how does the behavior of soldiers on the battlefield affect their religion after the war? And that, I think, is a very, very, very interesting topic of research that I really just sort of offer some teasers on in the text.
Yeah, you hear the old statement, there are no atheists in foxholes, but I know a lot of atheists who came out of foxholes.
Right.
And so it can work both ways. And
yep.
I think that is a very cool
yes.
research agenda that's left open, that either you'll be investigating, your RAs will be investigating, or perhaps some entrepreneurial graduate student looking for a dissertation and who wants to head out either to Cal Berkeley or to the University of Washington maybe can pick that up as a topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And the intuition right now seems to be that if you enter the battlefield with a pretty profound religious foundation, meaning not just an understanding of religion and a religious background, but a grappling with religion, a series of clearly defined religious practices, meaning you have a community around you, you have texts that you use, you have a chaplain who you access, et cetera, that this really stands by your side in the battlefield and can give you something to lean on. And in fact, the experience of battle can in turn, strengthen your religious attachment.
Right.
Can, doesn't always. However, if you enter the battlefield with a flimsy notion of how benign God is and how wonderful miracles are, the encounter with the horror of the battlefield will often clash with that notion, very easily undermine it because it's a simplistic notion, and then you're left with a double whammy. First of all, one of the primary aspects of your personality, namely your religious belief, has suddenly evaporated. And second of all, that extra layer of protection that you had, if the mental health research is correct, is also suddenly gone. And so people with a weak religious foundation seem to do worse on the battlefield than even atheists. They have the religion completely knocked out of them and come out of the war often with a tremendous anger.
Yeah, militantly atheist. Yeah, it's a kind of a curling.
Tremendous anger. You see this in British writing after World War I.
Yeah.
Tremendous anger at the chaplains, tremendous anger at the church, tremendous anger at God, and a deep sense of nihilism that is then often associated with depression, suicide, etc.
Yeah, no, definitely a topic worthy of study.
Yeah.
There's another chapter that you have in your book that really takes all of what you've done in the previous chapters and wrap it into a study of the Iraq War. That's your big case study. You do have all these little mini case studies as you go along. I'm going to let readers encounter that for themselves. And so we're going to link to your book, Religion on the Battlefield, on our website. And I do recommend people pick it up because it's a great read. It's a very academic book, but it's extremely readable as well. I want to end up with one question, though, because this is something that I think you and I kind of share in many respects, that when you entered graduate school, you were probably pretty much like the standard international relations student who wanted to do all the stuff that standard international relations students do and study, right? And you'll look at war, or maybe you'll do international political economy and trade pacts and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But along the way, you do something different, something really different that a lot of other people have not done before. You really kind of bushwhacked a new path. And that's always exciting. But, you know, forging your way in academia, bushwhacking new paths can often be fraught with some perils. I want to just ask professionally, what have you learned in this process that you think other scholars of international relations should pay attention to, or more specifically, graduate students who are kind of bubbling up through the ranks right now?
Right. So I'll try to keep it brief because, you know, you're asking a very good and complicated question. So I'll give a short answer, and then you tell me how much more of an answer you want. The number one advice that I now give my graduate students, based on your precise question, is take classes outside the department. Interest yourselves in debates outside political science. In fact, outside the social sciences, if you can. Sit in on strange, surprising, unexpected classes. In part, they'll be terribly boring, and they'll be just the person standing in front of the class talking their mouth off, and you won't even exactly understand what they're saying. But it'll force you to sit there and contemplate and gather your thoughts, and maybe they'll say something strange that will give you an idea that you will pursue that will lead to another idea, and suddenly you'll have an interesting argument on your hands. Or maybe they will actually say something that's quite relevant that your field has simply never taken into account, a wisdom from some other discipline. So that's the main direction in which that experience has pushed me, and that is be as interdisciplinary as you can. And the wonderful thing about IR, and the reason why I sometimes feel sad for my American politics colleagues and to some extent for my comparative politics colleagues, is IR really is the most interdisciplinary of political science fields. There's nothing on the University of California, Berkeley campus that you can study. Architecture, modern dance, ancient Egyptian pottery, nuclear physics. There's nothing you can study on this campus that isn't in some way relatable to international affairs to the benefit of both disciplines.
Yeah. No, amen to that. Although I would qualify it, say, us comparative political folks are pretty good at that stuff, too. It's the Americanness that we got to worry about. And in many ways, too, I mean, you look at the field of American politics, and it has become rather mundane of just running regressions on voting and stuff, and it really misses some of the deep historical things or comparisons with, well, why do we do things here in America, but they do things different in New Zealand or something? Those are the cool things that we should be paying attention to.
Absolutely.
And any reflections on how your career to this point has turned out pursuing that path? Any regrets?
So I have to say, back in the late 1990s when I started studying religion, it was not easy.
Yeah.
It wasn't a topic a lot of political scientists were interested in. There wasn't much work for me to base my arguments on. And so I went to the religious studies department. And took classes there and even picked up a small graduate degree, learned a lot about the sociology of religion, read some classics in the study of religion that no political scientist would otherwise ever come across. And even though it wasn't always easy convincing people that this mattered, I thought it was always a worthwhile struggle, and tragic world events have sometimes made my life easier. 9/11 helped in perverse ways. The rise of ISIS is now helping. The fact that religion is becoming a theme that cannot be ignored in American politics, in European politics, in Middle Eastern politics, is really helping grow this sub-subfield of people who are studying religion and politics. So now we have, for almost a decade now, we've had a prospering religion section in the American Political Science Association. For 5 years now, we've had a religion section in the International Studies Association. That section, which I'm pretty familiar with, has now over 200 members, even though it's existed for less than 5 years. So there's now a community of people who study this that didn't exist 15 years ago. And that's a fantastic resource.
Yeah. No, amen to that as well, too. I kind of share that same experience. Yeah, and me.
And you.
And research on religious podcasts.
And you. And new journals that are coming out.
Yeah.
A new series on religion and conflict that is about to be launched by Cornell that I will edit. More and more institutions and resources that are helping buttress this study.
And that is really cool. So for all you people thinking about getting into this field, it is a growth industry, and you should be looking into it more. My guest today has been Ron Hassner. Ron, thanks for coming back to Research on Religion.
My delight. Always happy to be here.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts,
please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.